All right, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, and it is Wednesday, October 8th. And you had the test last time. Haven't graded the test yet, but I'll probably maybe get them graded today. You'll have them by the weekend to look on Blackboard. All right, so hang in there just another day or so. And you can check your grades, and you all know how to get onto Blackboard. So we're talking about muscles today, and there's something that I skipped over in the previous chapter, and that was the neuromuscular junction. And someone pointed out to me that it is listed as an exam figure, but I didn't actually make a picture of it and put it on Blackboard for you to practice labeling. And also there's something called a motor unit, which is an exam figure in the list, but again, for some reason, it didn't get put into your list of figures that you have to know. So I want to go over those two things before we finish up muscles. Okay? So I'm just going to lecture a little bit on the board and then show you some pictures of this stuff. But so we're going to first talk about a synapse. Does anybody have an idea what the heck a synapse is?
It's like a branch of a neuron.
Yeah, it's like a branch of a neuron. You could think of that. Okay, it's on the end of a neuron. And what controls skeletal muscle? Nerves do. Right? So there's an end of a neuron, or what we call an axon terminus, right where it meets a muscle fiber, in particular skeletal muscle. Remember, skeletal muscle is the only kind of muscle that's under voluntary control. So a synapse communicates with the muscle, skeletal muscle, and actually tells it when to contract. And that neuron is getting signals from their brain, as a matter of fact, your conscious brain, to tell that muscle to contract. So a synapse is a way that two cells can communicate with each other. So you might not want to think specifically about excitation, right? But it is communication. It's a way that nerves, that different cells in general can communicate with each other. So a synapse is what I call the structural, which means what? Anatomy and functional, which means what? Physiology, unit of something in your body, of, okay, communication. All right, so a synapse is a structural and functional unit of communication. So if you know something about the synapse, you know how cells can communicate with each other. All right, so that's real important that cells know how to communicate with each other. And we have two different kinds of synapses. The first kind is what we call a chemical synapse. And the second kind, which is probably what I'm going to talk about first, is an electrical synapse. All right, so you probably have a feel. We don't talk about this very much in this class, but you probably have a feeling that the cells in your body actually produce electricity. You are very electrical beings. As a matter of fact, every cell in your body acts like a battery. So have you ever touched an electrical socket or an electrical cord by accident? It has an effect on your body, and the reason why it has an effect on your body is because your body normally uses electricity for communication and control. And guess what kind of tissue uses, if you're going to pick one, uses electricity more than any other kind of tissue? You would say, yeah, nervous tissue does. In particular, neurons, not neuroglia. Oh, we didn't get to nervous system yet. Ah, in this class. Okay, but we will in the next chapter. All right, but nervous system uses electricity a lot. But also muscles use electricity a lot. So muscles share that property with nerves. And that's why nerves can actually control muscles pretty easily, because of they share similar kinds of electrical properties. Okay, so in an electrical synapse, if we have two cells, they can communicate with each other electrically. So if there is an electrical signal in one cell, it can excite its neighbor electrically, which is a very rare kind of synapse. That there, you don't have very many of these. You need special kinds of connections between cells in order for this to happen. So if there's an electrical signal in one cell, okay, most cells don't really touch each other. There's always some extracellular space, right? But if there is an electrical synapse between these two cells, then there are like special kinds of holes in the membrane. So an electrical signal can go from one cell directly into the next. And these little connections right here are what we call gap junctions. So gap junctions allow electrical signals to flow from one cell to the next cell, and guess what? To the next cell, okay? And then to the next cell. So it can just flow from one cell to another, to another, to another. So that's important for certain kinds of tissues that should behave. If all the cells in one kind of organ, one organ in your body, if you want it to behave together in unison, and you might be able to think of an organ, even a muscle, when it contracts, okay, you want it to work in unison. Right? You don't want skeletal muscle to work in unison. For instance, if we had electrical synapses between all of skeletal muscles in your body, that would mean that as soon as you contracted one muscle cell or muscle fiber, what would happen to all the muscles in your body? They would contract, right? And that wouldn't work because you couldn't walk, you couldn't sit up straight, right? You want to have individual control of certain muscle groups in your body. So electrical synapses don't work for skeletal muscle, but guess what kind of muscle they work very nice for? Your heart, when it contracts, part of it shouldn't contract, and then another part, and then another part, and then another part, or independent. When the heart contracts, it should contract what? In unison, basically in unison to pump blood. That's very important. So these gap junctions, or electrical synapses we have in the heart, because you want your whole heart to contract, not just one side and then the other, the whole heart should contract together. So your heart has electrical synapses, and I'll leave this on the board. Okay, there are special junctions between cardiac muscle cells, and you probably already know what that's called. That's the intercalated disc, and one component of an intercalated disc are these gap junctions that allow electrical signals to flow from one cell to another, to another, to another. Okay. Now, that's not true with skeletal muscle, which is primarily what we're talking about in class today. That's a chemical synapse. All right, so what does a chemical synapse look like? I guess I'm going to have to maybe I can leave this up on the board. Well, an electrical synapse, let me give you a breakdown of it. You have a nerve going someplace from your brain, and information flows down that nerve as an electrical signal. And you'll learn a lot about these electrical signals in a physiology class. And then when it gets down to the axon terminus right here, it's going to synapse on a muscle fiber. What does a muscle fiber look like? It's really long and narrow, right? It kind of looks like a big tube. It's made up of thousands of cells at one time that coalesce to form that one single fiber, right? And there is a space between these two cells. And since there's a space, this electrical signal can't just flow into the muscle. It can't flow across this space. This space right here is what we call the synaptic cleft. So electricity can't hop across. But you could imagine if electricity hopped across, what it would be. What kind of electrical signal would have to be? What kind of electrical signal do you know that can hop through space? Like if I reach out and touch somebody, if I have static electricity, what would happen? You would get a shock. Okay, so there would be a lightning bolt. All right, so cells don't communicate with each other through lightning bolts. All right, that can't happen. So what happens is that this electrical signal gets converted within the synaptic cleft into a chemical, And then the chemical diffuses across the synaptic cleft, and it binds through this muscle fiber. And when it does, it starts another electrical signal on this muscle, and this electrical signal flows over the whole muscle cell. So in a chemical synapse, let's follow the type of signal from the neuron all the way into the muscle. First, it is what? Electrical signal. Secondly, it gets converted into a chemical signal that moves across the space, because chemicals will diffuse, right? If I open up a perfume bottle, that perfume is going to diffuse through the room. All right, so that chemical signal will diffuse through the synaptic cleft, and when it binds to the muscle cell right here, then it starts another electrical signal. So the third thing then is what? Another electrical signal in the muscle. So for a chemical synapse is what we have here. You have what? Electrical? Signal in the neuron. You have a chemical signal in the synapse. So I'm just going to put neuron right here. Neuron in the synapse. And that gets converted into another electrical signal. Where? In the muscle. And that electrical signal in the muscle causes the muscle to contract. Okay, so don't forget, for an electrical synapse, electricity just flows from one cell to another through these gap junctions. But in a chemical kind of synapse, the signal is electrical in the neuron, converted to a chemical signal in the synapse, which then causes another electrical signal in the muscle. So this right here, because it's in a muscle, right, it is a synapse, but we call this the neuromuscular junction. Neuromuscular junction. Okay, so it's a certain kind of chemical synapse between a neuron and a skeletal muscle cell. I saw a question up there someplace. Yeah, who had a question? Yeah? Oh, okay, here we are. Yeah? Yep, the muscle converts it to another electrical signal. Yeah, the muscle converts it to electrical signal, and you know that electrical signal in a muscle is very similar to this electrical signal that's on this axon right here of a neuron. Okay, but that electrical signal can't hop across the synaptic cleft. So when we talk about neurons in the next chapter, this will make a little bit more sense. But since we're talking about muscles, we need to talk about that neuromuscular junction and control a little bit, because that's an exam figure. Let's see, I don't know what the number of that figure is, but if you page through your book, if you come across it, it's not this one. That's a chemical synapse in a nerve. It's in the muscle chapter. Okay. But I'll use this one just for a description of what we're looking at. So here we have a nerve fiber, right, and an axon. So in this part of the nerve fiber, there is an electrical signal. It comes down to the terminal part of an axon, and that electrical signal has to stop. It can't flow into this next neuron over here. All right? Yeah, it's in the muscle chapter. Is this the muscle chapter? No, that's the nerve chapter, the preceding chapter. 249?
249.
249? Yeah, that's a neuron. Yeah. But I think you have a chapter in your muscle.
Yeah.
Introduction to muscle chapter. That's the one I really want you to know.
Okay.
Where's that?
249.
That is figure 10.9 on page 248. I don't have a picture to show you of that one. So I'm going to use another chemical synapse as a model to explain 10 point what? 10.9. Neuromuscular junction, 10.9. The neuromuscular junction, all right, you have signals coming in, electrical signals coming in on an axon. So here is an axon terminus. You have electrical signal, which we call a nerve impulse. And this is the terminal button on an axon, or the terminal ending. Sometimes it's called a bouton terminale. Sometimes it's called a terminal bouton. But it's a little swelling at the end of this nerve axon. And if we look inside this bouton terminale, we see a bunch of vesicles. And inside these vesicles are the chemical signal that eventually might cause, right, the stimulation of the muscle fiber. And these chemical signals are what we call neurotransmitters. So these little dots that I have on the board right here, these things are going to be secreted from the nerve. These are called neurotransmitters. These are neurotransmitters because they're being transmitted by what? This nerve right here. So they're called a neurotransmitter. And they're stored in this axon terminus. So when an electrical signal comes down to the axon terminus, it causes the fusing of these vesicles to the membrane right here. And when it fuses, the neurotransmitters that are inside the vesicle are released into the synaptic cleft right here. What basic process do we call that? When you have something inside of a vesicle, inside the cytoplasm of a cell, and it fuses to the membrane? Yeah, that's just typical exocytosis. That's an active transport mechanism. So that neurotransmitter is released into the synaptic cleft, and it will diffuse across that space and bind to the second cell, which we call the postsynaptic cell. The one in front of the synapse is what we call the presynaptic cell. So the presynaptic cell releases the neurotransmitter, and when neurotransmitter binds to the postsynaptic membrane, that causes the development of what? Another electrical signal, and that flows over the whole muscle cell into the T-tubules. Right, and that causes the filaments to slide past each other. What kind of filaments am I talking about? Like actin and myosin myofilaments? Okay, guys, have you studied that? Did we have to look at that in this? No, we didn't look at that in this class. Okay.
Okay.
Okay. Okay, so this right here is an example of a chemical synapse because it uses a neurotransmitter. And probably you're going to have to know what the name of that neurotransmitter is for skeletal muscle. It's always going to be exactly the same neurotransmitter at the neuromuscular junction. The neurotransmitter specifically is called acetylcholine. So acetylcholine is a neurotransmitter at the neuromuscular junction that causes muscle to contract. Okay. All right, so that's one thing I wanted to talk about. The slide that I'm showing right here is a synapse between two nerves. And when one nerve stimulates another nerve, do they move at all? Not really. They just transmit electrical signals. But if it's a neuromuscular junction, and there's a signal from an axon that stimulates a muscle, what's going to happen to that muscle?
Contract.
It's going to contract. And it might pull away from the neuron, and then the neuron won't be able to control that muscle anymore. It will lose communication. So the big difference between synapse between two neurons and the neuromuscular junction is that there are some extra parts to the synapse that make sure that the muscle can't pull away from the neuron. Right, so there are more structures that keep those two cells just in the right position. And because this nerve right here will stimulate the muscle at this one point, if this nerve moves over to the other end of the muscle, it won't be able to excite it. If it moves to this end over here, it can't excite the muscle. It has to stay just in this location because this is where the special parts of the neuromuscular junction are. So there are special connections there to make sure that the nerve doesn't move away from the muscle fiber. So that's really the only difference, only major difference between a chemical synapse in a muscle and a chemical synapse between two neurons. Okay. So let's just review. Electrical synapses. Where would you find an electrical synapse? In a muscle. What kind of muscle? Like cardiac muscle. Because you want the whole heart organ to contract together. You don't ever want just the bottom part to contract and not the top part, or the right side and not the left side. All right, but for a chemical synapse, this is where you want very fine control communication between cells. So in your brain, for instance, what kind of synapses would you like to have in your brain? Would you like to have electrical or chemical? Okay, I would say chemical. I like your answer, because if it was electrical, as soon as you thought one thought, it would do what? It would stimulate your whole brain, and you would convulse, and you would think of everything you ever learned in your whole life that one instant. Okay, that would be like a Woody Allen movie or something, right? That doesn't happen. Okay, so you have chemical synapses in your brain so that you have fine control. You can pick what thoughts you want to think, for instance, or what parts of your body you want to control. Okay, so electrical synapses are kind of rare in your body. Okay, the other figure has to do with a motor unit. All right, so I'm going to erase synapse. And what's the figure for the motor unit? Is that that's like the very next one right there. That is 10.10. Is 10.10 on your list of exam figures? Yeah, I think it is. Okay. So you should look at that one too. And a motor unit refers to skeletal muscle as well. Not to cardiac muscle, not to smooth muscle. So for instance, let's talk, where's the biceps brachii at? That is in your anterior arm, right? Right here. What motion does it produce? Yeah, well, not extension.
Flexion,
because remember, muscles can only shorten, they can't push, they can only pull, right? So the biceps brachii is going to pull, it's going to flex your forearm or flex your elbow. And you should probably already know what the origin and insertion is. What's the origin is what? The more movable end or more stationary end? The more stationary end. Which is the more stationary end of the biceps? Yeah, the one up on the scapula. And it's called biceps because how many origins does it have? It's got two, right? It's got one on the coracoid process, that's the short head, and the long head goes to the supraglenoid tubercle above the glenoid cavity on the scapula. And what's the insertion? Because it goes across the elbow, it's got to be on the radial tuberosity on the radius, which is what, the lateral bone in the forearm. So when the biceps contracts, that causes flexion of the forearm. And so for instance, how much of that biceps do I need, for instance, to lift this marker up when I flex my forearm, all right, compared to when I lift this overhead projector up? Which one do you think is actually causing more muscle fibers of that biceps to contract? Remember, I got thousands, tens of thousands of muscle fibers in there. How many more are contracting when I lift the heavy weight? I should come here after class and lift that up a bunch of times. Compared to when I lift up something really light. Which one, which time is the muscle contracting with more power? The heavier object, right? If I were to use the same number of muscle fibers in my arm for the light object when I was, compared to when I was lifting up that heavy object, what would happen? Oh man, I just punched myself in the eye, right? Because I don't need so much muscle contracting for this light marker. So the muscle controls how many muscle fibers, or your brain controls how many muscle fibers are going to be contracting depending on how heavy it is. Okay. And that is just determined by how many muscle fibers are contracting. And you probably all sometimes were surprised at some point in time. There's a part of your brain that helps control that. Have you ever been in a restaurant and there's this big mug, big glass mug filled with water? And so you reach out and you're going to take a drink out of that mug that's really heavy glass filled with water, and you lift it up and it starts like flying off the table. You're going to spill it on whoever you're sitting next to, because the mug's not made out of glass, it's made out of what?
Plastic,
and it surprised you. But your brain figured that out right away, and it shut down some of those muscle fibers so that you didn't lose your water. All right, so it's important to control. And that's where this concept of motor unit comes in. A motor unit is defined as one motor neuron. So here is an axon from a nerve coming from your brain, and it's going to split. What do we call a split in anatomy?
Bifurcation.
Bifurcation, that's right. It's going to bifurcate or trifurcate. And then, so this one right here is going to go to this muscle right here. And it's going to go to this one right here. So it's going to cause these two fibers to contract. So a motor unit is the motor neuron. Right, that because a motor neuron is going to cause some kind of effect in your body, and the number of fibers that it goes to in this particular case is what? Only two. All right. So this is the kind of motor unit you might have in one part of your body where you want to have fine control. What part of your body do you want to have fine control? A lot of axons going to a lot of different motor units so that you can just excite one motor unit if it's a very light kind of motion, or it can stimulate thousands of motor units and contract all of those muscle fibers in a muscle. What part of your body do you need to have fine control over? Fingers. Yeah. Facial expression. Muscles of facial expression and articulation, right, where you need to have fine discriminative control. But what kinds of muscles have large motor units? They might have one motor axon going to a couple hundred fibers. So almost the whole muscle contracts every time you use it. What kind of muscles don't you need to write with or speak with, for instance? Like legs, for instance, we do some dexterity with legs, but postural muscles, like our back muscles, don't need to have a lot of nerves going to your back muscles because either they contract or they don't, right? You don't do special kinds of tasks with your back muscles. Okay, so a motor unit is what? The one nerve fiber and the number of muscle fibers that are connected to it. That's a motor unit. And what do we call this connection between this axon terminus and the muscle? What do we call that? That's a synapse. Yeah, what kind of synapse?
Neuromuscular
junction, right? So it's a synapse, but because it's a special kind, we call it the neuromuscular junction. But remember, we also learned two different kinds of synapses. What are the two kinds? You got chemical and electrical. Yeah, chemical and electrical. Which kind is this one? This is the chemical kind of synapse. So if it's a chemical synapse, that means that this neuron is secreting a neurotransmitter because that's the chemical. And in particular, what's the specific name of the neurotransmitter at the neuromuscular junction? Yeah. What is neurotransmitter, ER, at the neuromuscular junction? So the question would be answered ACH. That stands for acetylcholine. That's how we always abbreviate it. Okay, so your body uses all kinds of different neurotransmitters. Anybody know another name of a neurotransmitter, a different kind of neurotransmitter?
Dopamine
is one in our brain. Epinephrine, norepinephrine. Okay, so you'll learn some different kinds of neurotransmitters. Serotonin is another one. Okay, and they all have different purposes in your body. So this is a nice chemical synapse right here. Okay, so I think over the weekend, look at those two figures, make sure you can label them and sort of get a sense for what's going on. And if you got a question, you have to ask me about it on Monday. Okay, maybe Monday I'll find those figures. Okay. So I guess I will move this up down. So we're in what, chapter 11? Chapter 11. Okay. Last time we looked at actions of muscles, but we also talked about how some muscles are named, right? So for instance, here's that circular skeletal muscle. So a circular skeletal muscle most of the time is going to be called what kind of muscle? Orbicularis. There's only one that I know of that's called a sphincter. A sphincter is usually saved to talk about a smooth muscle. A circular smooth muscle is a sphincter. All right, so circular smooth is called a sphincter. We'll find some sphincters later on in this class. So a circular muscle, what? We'll close your mouth, close your eyes. If it's a circular smooth muscle, it's going to be around a tube of some kind, like maybe a blood vessel, digestive tract, and when it contracts, it's going to do what? It's going to act like a valve or a gate that will allow for movement of material through that tube or prevent movement through a tube. That would be the purpose of a sphincter. Okay. So some other things that we looked at. The importance of antagonism. I can't tell you how important this is. Will really help your memorization of muscles. Make sure you learn muscles by what body compartment they're in and know what body compartment produces what kind of motion. So maybe I could ask you just a couple things real quick. All right, so anterior thigh. What are all these muscles in the anterior thigh? We haven't looked at any yet, but today we're going to look at some. When these contract, it's going to extend the leg, right? That's leg extension. What about posterior thigh? That is flexion, right? So those two compartments are on opposite sides of your body. They will produce opposite motion. What is a cool term that scientists use to describe opposite when things have opposite mechanisms or work in opposition to each other? That is antagonism. And that's a really good thing to employ in control systems. Antagonism is a good thing. Don't have a negative connotation to it. All right, what about anterior arm? All these muscles are going to flex. Posterior arm, these are going to extend the forearm. Anterior forearm are going to flex the digits or flex the wrist, right? Whether it's a carpi or a digitorum kind of muscle, the posterior forearm is going to extend the wrist if it's a carpi or extend the digits if it's a digitorum. And then they're named by whether they're on the lateral side, it's going to be what, a radialis muscle, or if it's on the medial side, it's going to be a ulnaris. And if there's one smack in the middle, that's just called the palmaris. Okay. You also have some that pronate and supinate. You probably should know where the, at least a pronator I think you have to know in lab. Okay. The only motion that's really strange, all right, and I'll talk about it in just a second, but think the motion of the hip is not hard to understand. Okay, so if I move the hip, don't look at my leg, just look at my thigh and my hip right here. So if I do this, what's this at the hip? That's flexion, and this is extension, right? So that's easy to appreciate by just the general rules. Now, what about the shoulder? This is the one that really doesn't make a lot of sense unless you compare it to the hip. So if I just move my shoulder like that, all right, I don't see an angle increasing or decreasing. So this is flexion at the shoulder, this is extension, and then this is hyperextension, right? And the best way to just see that without memorizing a lot or getting turned around is just perform the same motion with your hip, right? So this is flexion, the motion is the same moving anteriorly, and then moving back down is extension, and then moving back like that is hyperextension. So that will help you see what muscles produce flexion, for instance, and extension. Right? Extension, the prime mover for extension would be the latissimus dorsi. Right? And there's a number for flexion, including the pectoralis. So those are kind of the hardest ones to see. Okay. All right, so I don't know if this is an exam figure or not, but it probably should be. It doesn't have a whole lot of muscles on it. It just has a bunch of major superficial muscles. Okay, and I think we went over all of the trunk last time, but let's see if I can see some things pretty easily. Well, yeah, what do we got over here? Well, we got the orbicularis oris, orbicularis oculi, right? Here is the frontalis, and we see the temporalis over here, masseter. This one isn't labeled, so this is a good one. What's this one right here? I would say that is the buccinator, right? That holds food between your teeth when you're chewing. And then these up over here are the zygomaticus. There's another one deep, which is what we call the, the levator. I like that. Thanks. I got stuck. I forgot the first word. Levator, labii, right? Because it's a lip muscle superioris. All right, and then this is probably what, the depressor anguli oris. All right, so that goes over a bunch of the muscles for facial expression and mastication. Oh, but a couple of muscles we can't see for mastication, which are attached to the sphenoid bone and the mandible. So it's deep inside here. They're important for mastication. What muscles am I thinking of? Yeah, the medial and lateral pterygoids. And these are important for, especially for grinding the jaw back and forth, for grinding food, because you only use one at a time. All right, here's another muscle that sometimes you only use one at a time. This is the sternocleidomastoid. And if they both contract bilaterally, what's the motion? That is going to be flexion of the neck or cervical spine. What muscle is antagonistic to the sternocleidomastoid? Now, how are you going to approach that problem? What should you immediately think of? If you can memorize muscles, that's easy, because you just say the name of the muscle out. But if you don't like to memorize, I don't think I really like to memorize very much. All right. I think of, okay, well, this is the anterior neck. If I'm looking for an antagonistic muscle, where should I look? Posterior neck. So what do you have in the posterior neck? You've got the splenius capitis. So you can kind of figure that out, even though you haven't memorized it, but you at least got to know the name of the muscle that's back there. All right, so splenius capitis and sternocleidomastoid are antagonistic to each other. Okay. This other one we don't make too much of a note of. This is the platysma. That's sort of facial expression a little bit, but it also depresses the mandible. You don't have a whole lot of muscles that lower the jaw, because gravity does a really good job. You've got strong muscles that elevate the jaw, but there's another one that depresses the jaw. Anybody know another muscle that opens the mouth? It is the digastric muscle that depresses the mandible. Okay. The other thing probably you should know are muscles for inspiration. What muscles are important for inspiration, and maybe what muscles are important for expiration? The most important is the diaphragm. For which motion? For inspiration, right? We have, and usually we use that muscle, but people that have emphysema, for instance, or when you're hyperventilating, you need other muscles besides the diaphragm. And those would be the scalenes. They're not on this diagram right here, are important. And also some intercostals. What muscles of the intercostal group? The external intercostals for inspiration. Okay, they're named external not because it matches up with inspiration, but it's because it's the external layer of muscles between the ribs. They elevate the ribs. So scalenes do that. And even the pectoralis minor, when somebody is hyperventilating, is used because it can elevate the ribs as well. So when somebody is living out their daily life from day to day and they have trouble inhaling, all right, guess what muscles have a tendency to hypertrophy and get bigger? The scalenes, pectoralis minor, and people that have emphysema have a very classical kind of look to them, right? They're very muscular in their upper thorax right here because those muscles help them, what, breathe because they have trouble breathing. And their chest gets very barrel-shaped as well, okay? Okay, well, let's see what other kinds of muscles we can find over here. So let's go to, here's all some good ones. We're done talking about these already. Oh, muscles of the posterior trunk. What are we going to call muscles of the posterior trunk? I passed by it already, but it kind of brought it to my attention. There's hundreds of muscles, and you have to know one. because a part of these muscles are grouped, okay, posterior trunk, right, your posterior trunk, you got to know one muscle back there of hundreds. Those are called the erector spinae, okay, erector spinae. And what's the motion of the erector spinae? They do what? Yeah, extend the thorax, right, or the thoracic vertebral column. What muscles are antagonistic to that? Rectus abdominis, right, and probably maybe even the oblique muscles as well. Okay. All right, so that's how you should know all those different things. Okay. One thing that I will mention, I don't think it's on your list to know, but so here we see a pelvis right here. I can't tell if this is male or female. It looks like female. Oh, yeah, it's definitely female because here we see vagina right here. Okay. All right, so always look for clues. That would be a good clue right there. Okay. Okay. So this right here is the pelvic cavity, right? So it's part of the abdominal pelvic cavity. And you can see a bunch of muscles. You don't have to know the names of any of these muscles right here, but I do want you to know what all of these muscles comprise. All of these muscles form the base of the pelvic cavity. And in a lot of anatomy classes, we just kind of pass it by thinking people are just automatically going to know what this thing is. Does anybody know what this structure is that's composed of all these different muscles right here? We use it all the time in clinical settings. This is what we call the perineum. Not peritoneum, but the perineum. Okay, so the perineum are all of the muscles and connective tissues that form what the base of the pelvic cavity. And that's important, of course, in maybe this individual right here for childbirth, because sometimes the perineum has to be cut to allow for the child to enter and go through the birth canal. Okay, so all these muscles make up the perineum. Just kind of, yeah, put that in your memory someplace. I'll never ask you that on a test, but you'll be wondering the rest of your life what the perineum is. You took an anatomy class and you never heard of it, but now you've kind of heard it. Okay, so we're going to look at some muscles of the appendages today. I think we did talk about the coracobrachialis. I think we left off here maybe last time. Okay, and here we can see the pectoralis minor that helps in inspiration sometimes for forced inspiration. What would you guess the action of the coracobrachialis is? Remember, only muscles can only pull. They can't push. So this is going to be? Yeah, it's going to work on the shoulder. Ah, what's that motion? That's that strange motion. That doesn't make sense. Yeah, that's flexion of the shoulder, but it also does this as well. Okay, that is what? Adduction. So it weakly adducts the shoulder as well. Okay. It's a weak adductor of the shoulder, as opposed to abduction.
Rotator cuff?
It's not a part of the rotator cuff, although it does go across the shoulder. It's working across the shoulder. But more important muscles that form the fibrous capsule of the shoulder are the subscapularis. I see a little bit of it right here. Okay. As well as the infraspinatus, the supraspinatus, and one of the teres muscles. Which teres muscle? The teres minor. Yeah, teres minor. Hi. I'll be right back. Just a second. Yeah. So I've got the test right here, but the instructor from last night didn't give me the keys back.
Oh.
I'm recording right now, so I don't know. You know who the instructor is from last night?
No.
Oh. Fumio. So if you can track him down,
sure.
He's got that. Plus, I also have, if you have time, I have an audiometer in the very bottom drawer. People can check their hearing out. And it could take maybe 3 or 4 weeks for people to work through that whole thing.
Is it in the bottom of the...
I think it's labeled Gober on the drawer.
Gotcha.
Cool.
Okay.
All right. I'll stop in after class. Okay, I had to multitask there a little bit. So when did we start? 10:30?
Yes.
Okay, good. Good, good, good. All right, so we still got a little time left. Okay, so next slide. Let's see what we have right here. Ah, some back muscles. Well, here we see some muscles of the rotator cuff. All right, so I don't know if this is an exam figure, but it's a really good figure because I can see what the supraspinatus, the infraspinatus, here's the teres major, and tucked away right under here is the teres minor. All right, so the teres minor causes, it's on the posterior side of the humerus, so what kind of motion is going to be produced by the teres minor? It connects to the back up over here. Well, can it push or can it only pull?
Pull.
It can only pull. So it's going to cause a lateral rotation. Right? It's going to cause a lateral rotation. But now let's look at the teres major right here. Where is the insertion of the teres major? Is it posterior or anterior? It's the opposite side of the humerus. So the motion of the teres major is going to be medial rotation. Teres minor is lateral rotation. So these are rotators of the humerus, all right? And so since it causes rotation, and they're important because notice how close they get to the glenohumeral joint right here. These, not the teres major, because it's way down over here, but the minor and the infraspinatus, we just call that the rotator cuff because these are involved with rotation of the humerus.
So the teres major is the lateral?
Is the medial rotator. It rotates medially. And the teres minor rotates laterally. Okay. And the way to see that is just by looking at the structure of the shoulder joint. So again, that's a nice structural functional relationship. Right? So if you appreciate structure, it's easier to appreciate the function. Yeah, they're rotators, but only the teres minor is close enough to the joint capsule to be actually part of the joint capsule. So it's part of the rotator cuff. Should I write down on the board again the muscles that make up the rotator cuff? Okay, that is what? Sits. Just think of sits. Yes, yeah, sits is what? Subscapularis. I is infraspinatus. T is teres minor. And then S is the... Did I say subscapularis? Supraspinatus is the other one. Okay, those four. Those make up the rotator cuff, which is a very common kind of injury to have. Okay, so so here is the prime mover for arm extension. This is the latissimus dorsi. The deltoid. Okay, has a number of different divisions to it, right? So the deltoid, if the anterior division is contracting, that will cause some flexion. If the posterior division is contracting, it's going to cause some extension. But if the middle division contracts, it's going to cause, and I had to rotate my humerus because I have a little rotator cuff problem right there, but I got it working. All right, that causes what? That is abduction, right? Deltoid causes abduction. The rhomboideus muscles, you probably have to know in lab. Here's the major and the minor, right? And levator scapulae, these don't cause a motion in an appendage, but they do what? What do these muscles do? They do something to the scapula. What do they do to the scapula? They what we call fix it in position, so these muscles are called fixators. Right, so they're not antagonists, they're not synergists, they're what we call fixators. So fixators you could think of as synergists because they work with other muscles, but they just stabilize the scapula. Okay. So these, I think we've talked about all these muscles already. Okay, muscles of the forearm. And we're looking at an anterior forearm. So all of these muscles are going, what's the action of all these muscles? They're going to be flexors of some kind, right? Well, the first one, and I have a tendency, I would like to, if I'm going to memorize, I'm going to memorize an order of maybe from medial to lateral or lateral to medial. just kind of memorize that and then look at the muscles and see if I can trace it out on a model someplace. All right, so the first one here, the lateral muscle, is the brachioradialis. Brachioradialis. The next one, flexor carpi radialis, right, because it's going to the lateral carpal. All right, and then the flexor, I'm going to skip over one. Then the most medial is the flexor carpi ulnaris. All right, so between the flexor carpi radialis and flexor carpi ulnaris is the palmaris longus. All right, so those I think you have to know for lab. I don't know if you have to know any of these deeper muscles. Okay, so what do we got? Brachioradialis, flexor carpi radialis, palmaris longus, flexor carpi ulnaris. So just kind of trace that out. I tell you what you could do. Get a magic marker and actually draw them on your person. But guess what? You can't take the practicum like that. You have to take a shower this month to do that. But that might be helpful. Okay? Or maybe another way of doing it so you don't have to draw on yourself is just draw on a piece of paper what an arm looks like with this hand right here. And then draw the muscles in and label them. Okay? Okay, that could help you in lab. All right, so here are some deeper layers, which I'm not too concerned with. I do want to show you one other thing. Okay, here is a broad, flat sheath of connective tissue. It's neither a ligament, and it's not a tendon either. But it forms a bracelet around a bunch of other tendons, right, from the pronator, from the brachioradialis and the flexor muscles and the palmaris longus, right here, that keep them all aligned in your wrist. And these broad, flat sheaths that form like a round ligament, we call it a retinaculum. Right, and this one is what we call the flexor retinaculum. It is just connective tissue that holds all of these tendons in position. And of course, if people are doing the same kind of motion with their hands all the time, what kind of folks are doing the same kind of motions with their hands all the time? Okay, people typing on a computer all day long, dental hygienists that are working, cleaning teeth all day long with the same kind of motion. All right, they can suffer from carpal tunnel type syndrome, and that's an inflammation of this whole area right here, including what? The retinaculum. All right, the retinaculum. Okay, posterior arm. These are not going to be flexors. These are all going to be extensors. Not quite as complicated. Usually in our body, extensors are not as strong. They're not as developed as flexors. All right, so if your whole body was going to go into contraction, if all the muscles were going to contract in your body, generally, what would your body look like? Extended or flexed? Would be flexed because those muscles are stronger. All right, so you don't have to know too many of these muscles right here. But let's take a look at these. All right, so you have the flexor carpi ulnaris. All right, this is the first one on the medial side, then the extensor carpi ulnaris, and then the extensor digitorum superficially right here, and extensor carpi radialis right here, which is a very, very small kind of muscle. And the extensor carpi radialis longus is up over here, right next to the brachioradialis. Well, there's another muscle that I wanted to show you. I might have to go back. It's a lot easier to see in lab than here. Okay? And that is what? This one right here, the pronator teres. That one you do have to know. So we got brachioradialis, pronator teres, flexor carpi radialis, palmaris longus, flexor carpi ulnaris. So I would be able to make sure you can draw all of those out. Okay. Cross-sectional anatomy, we don't deal with very much in this class. all the little muscles of the hand we don't deal with at all. Unless somebody really feels bad about that, we can take a look at that sometime. Okay, let's look at some muscles of the lower appendage. And there are some muscles for flexion of the hip. So what's flexion of the hip? Like this, right? That's flexion. The most important ones that work across the hip are the iliopsoas. And there's two divisions for the iliopsoas. There is the psoas major and psoas minor right here. These come from the vertebral bodies of lumbar vertebrae. And then they course inferiorly, and they're going to join up with the iliacus. And the origin of the iliacus is the ala of the ilium, right here. Right? And so when these come together, that forms the iliopsoas, and then that inserts into the femur. And so when that contracts, that's going to do what? That's going to pull the femur up toward the ilium. Okay, there's another couple muscles that are important for flexion, and that is the sartorius, as well as this one division of the quadriceps. This is the rectus femoris. All right, so the origin of the sartorius right here is the anterior superior iliac spine, and this muscle is noteworthy. Does anybody know why the sartorius is a noteworthy muscle? People, it's the longest muscle in your body, right? And sometimes we call that the Taylor's muscle because this is the muscle that stabilizes your legs when you're sitting down and your legs are crossed, when you're cross-legged like that. So people that used to be tailors would have these big bolts of fabric or hides, and their hands were sewing. So in order to move the material, how would they move the material around? They would use their legs and their knees, right? So they would have these big hypertrophied sartorius muscles. Okay, so let's look at the medial compartment. Guess what? All these muscles in the medial thigh, I didn't actually tell you anything about these, but remember, muscle can only pull, it can't push. So what's the motion of all these muscles in the medial thigh? They're going to? I don't like flexion so much. They're going to pull, right, on the medial femur up to the pubis up over here, or the ischium. So these are going to adduct. So these are all adductors. All right, so you got, I don't think you have to know the pectineus, but you got adductor longus, you got adductor magnus right here, and you've got gracilis. So these are all adductors of the thigh. So if we want to find an abductor, where do we look? We're going to look in the lateral thigh. Don't have a lot of muscles in the lateral thigh, but here is one, the tensor fascia lata, right here. Tensor fascia lata. Latte. Okay, sounds like a drink. Okay. Notice it's a short muscle. You can't abduct your thigh with a lot of strength, right? But in order to maintain balance, you need a lot of strength for these adductors so that your legs don't, your feet don't slip out for underneath you. Okay, so here is the abductor. And here is another broad, flat, tendinous sheath. So you could consider this an aponeurosis, but it's got a name. And so this one right here is called the iliotibial tract. You have to know the iliotibial tract in lecture, in lab. I can't remember if you do or not. All right, so on your lateral thigh, you feel something very stiff and solid right there. Those muscles are contracting, but they're pushing on that iliotibial tract right here. They can get inflammation there. There are bursas in there, okay? And that produces a lot of soreness when you get bursitis for sure. You don't want to. Okay, so the most anterior muscle group in the anterior thigh is what we call the quadriceps femoris. So guess how many origins the quadriceps has?
Four.
It's got four, right? You can tell in the name. And most of those muscles, actually all of those muscles, will insert via a common tendon right here. This is what we call the tendon of the quadriceps femoris. And it attaches to the patella. And then there's a bone-to-bone connection between the patella and the tibial tuberosity, right? This was on your exam last time. So we call that the patellar ligament. So all of the quadriceps insert into the patella via this common tendon right here. And we can see three of these muscles, the rectus femoris, the vastus lateralis, and vastus medialis right here. Okay, but we don't see the vastus intermedius, which is deep to the rectus femoris. All right, so most of these originate from the femur. The only one that doesn't is the rectus femoris. The rectus femoris actually originates from the ilium. Okay, I think it is the anterior inferior iliac spine. So the rectus femoris works across the hip. So if it's working across the hip, what kind of motion do you think it can produce across the hip? So it's going to be a flexor of the hip as well, right? So it's not the prime mover, because the prime mover is the iliopsoas right here. So that's the only one of the quadriceps that not only can extend the leg, but it can also flex the thigh or flex at the hip. All right, so the anterior thigh is pretty easy to see. All right, so here's that vastus intermedius muscle that you can see. It does not work across the hip. So in terms of the quadriceps, I suppose this would be sort of an advanced kind of question, but what would be the division of the quadriceps that can flex the hip? It's not on this slide right here. You see three of the divisions of the quadriceps here. So you could just, by deduction, tell me what? That it's the rectus femoris that can flex the hip, but not the vastus lateralis, not the vastus medialis, not the vastus intermedius right here. Okay, so here you see all the adductors. You might have to know some of these. All right, here's the posterior thigh. These you definitely have to know for lab. Okay, for instance, let's work with what we call the hamstrings. Does anybody know how many muscles make up the hamstrings? And generally what their action is? The hamstrings are posterior thigh, three muscles. And these, I like to start from medial. It's the semimembranosus here and here. And then a superficial muscle that sits on top of the semimembranosus. This is the semitendinosus. It has this long tendon right here. And then the biceps, what? Femoris. So these three. So you got three muscles that make up the hamstrings. From medial to lateral is the semimembranosus, then the semitendinosus, and then the biceps brachii. And the way that I remember this, right, semimembranosus, there's all these M's in membranosus, and there's what, an M in medial. So that's how I remember without thinking too much about which muscles are which. And then the biceps femoris is the lateral one. And the semitendinosus is right on top of the semimembranosus. Okay. And then here is that gracilis muscle once again. And the gracilis you can always tell because it's a very long and narrow strap-like muscle. Yeah, question? No, okay. Okay, that's fine. Okay, so gracilis, semimembranosus, semitendinosus, and biceps femoris. All right, so here's another muscle that inserts into the iliotibial tract along with the tensor fascia lata, and that's the gluteus maximus. Right, gluteus maximus. And the gluteus maximus motion, what's the motion of the gluteus maximus? And what's antagonistic to the gluteus maximus? Gluteus maximus is what, anterior or posterior? Posterior. It's posterior, that's right, it is your posterior. What is anterior? We just looked at that muscle. That is the iliopsoas. What does the iliopsoas do? That flexes the thigh, the gluteus maximus extends the thigh. All right, so again, just by getting familiar with different body compartments is really helpful to understand motions. All right, so the hamstrings, the important motion of the hamstrings, when those contract, and I might see a lot during the next test of people exercising during the test, right? So you can kind of tell when those muscles contract, what part of your body is going to move? Your leg. Right? So this is what? That's flexion. Flexion of the leg Hamstrings, extension of the leg is the opposite body compartment, namely the quadriceps. Okay. Okay, let's look at now muscles of the leg. All right, so muscles of the leg are going to act across the ankle in particular. All right, and we see another retinaculum around the ankle. And the most anterior muscle in the leg, this is what we call the tibialis anterior. All right, so here's the tibialis anterior. And all the muscles of that anterior leg are going to do what at your ankle or your digits of your toes? It's going to lift your foot off, your toes off the ground, or, and what do we call that? Lifting your toes? It's a kind of flexion. What kind of flexion? It's called dorsiflexion. So that's a prime mover for dorsiflexion. Okay. Okay, let's look at some muscles in the posterior. So here's your tibialis anterior. Extensor hallucis longus, that's for your big toe. Here's your fibularis. These are for, yeah, for your little toe. Extensor digitorum longus for extending all of your other toes. Okay, posterior compartment. Let's start with the most posterior muscle, gastrocnemius. And gastroc, it probably was named because it reminded somebody of a stomach. That's probably where that name came from. It just has a kind of nice bulbous stomach shape, gastrocnemius. And it has a very long tendon, which is what we call the Achilles tendon, or calcaneal tendon, right here. You can see it insert into, what bone is this right here? That's the calcaneus. All right, so when the gastrocnemius shortens, it's going to pull this posterior part of the calcaneus superiorly, and that's going to do what to your foot? Your toes. That's going to move your toes into the ground. We call that plantar flexion. So the gastrocnemius is the prime mover, probably the prime mover for plantar flexion, but it works with another one, which is just deep to the gastrocnemius. That is the soleus right here. So you can see these on the models up in lab very easily. The soleus inserts into the calcaneal tendon along with the gastrocnemius and produces the same motion. Okay, so that would be for plantar flexion. Okay, so here you can see the gastrocnemius and then the soleus inserting into the calcaneus via the calcaneal tendon or the Achilles tendon. Okay, so I think that's really all the muscles. Again, know your muscles by body compartment. That's very helpful. Muscles of the foot, we're not going to pay much attention to. And these different fulcrums, we're not going to learn in this class either. Okay, so that's pretty much it for muscles. But look at that neuromuscular junction, motor units over the weekend. And if you have some questions with that, and I'll try to find figures. So, all right, I'll put answers to your homework, everything for muscle. But the other thing that you should do over the weekend is your pre-lecture reading assignment for Introduction to Nervous System, because I'm going to start talking about nervous system. How many chapters does the next test have? It's got three? Ooh, so they're long chapters. Oh, that's right, Introduction to Muscle, the Muscle chapter, and then Nervous chapter, and the Nerve chapter is kind of long, so we only got three chapters, so now's a good time to start studying the nervous system over the weekend.